Radio.
What are the real choices for women in crisis pregnancy? A talk and panel discussion featuring Debbie Garrett, Anna Crone and Dr. Javina Graham. This event was held at the University of Notre Dame in October 2012.
We established in 2007, as you've already heard. I'm not going to talk a lot about what we do as an organisation, but certainly what we did see at that time was a market gap for professional services, professional resourcing and education of people working in the pregnancy support sector, but also a real gap in the provision of information about abortion to the general community, but to also to the professional sector and to women who were experiencing unintended or challenging pregnancies. And we, at the time, maybe rather naively thought, well, this will be great, we'll gather all the research and we'll just get it out there. People will love to hear it. But it has been a bit of an uphill battle to disseminate the information over that period of time. Over the last 5 years, we have, however, had some pretty significant achievements. We've been delivering a secondary schools program around the country. We've had two international conferences to which we've brought the world's experts on abortion, including the world's expert on men and abortion issues this year. We have commenced pilot programs to identify needs in communities of women experiencing unintended pregnancy, as well as just the needs generally of new mums. And we're beginning to establish a couple of pilot organisations to meet those needs. So they're sort of time-limited projects that we'll evaluate over time as well. We've also developed an online training course for anyone who might ever come into contact with a woman experiencing a challenging pregnancy and wants to know how best to manage that and how best to inform women. That course has been completed by about 90 students so far. And those students have ranged from lay people with no formal qualification or experience and just an interest in the field through to GPs, psychologists, mental health nurses who've undertaken the training as professional development. So it's been very well received. It's completely online, so it's accessible to anyone around the country. One of the things that we have found, I always thought, well, of course, if you tell the truth and you tell it respectfully, people like to listen. And that's been the case in lots of the roles I've had in the past in my professional experience. On the issue of abortion, it's not quite always the case that just because you tell the truth and you tell it respectfully and with a genuine concern that people will actually listen. What we've discovered is that, of course, the political and ideological sensitivities around women's reproductive health issues means that even the most rational of evidence and research really gets lost and makes the dissemination of information very difficult. Our beliefs about things like abortion are usually very strongly held. Most of the general public actually sit on the fence about the issue and have the kind of attitude of, well, I wouldn't have an abortion, but I think it should be available. However, if you have strongly held views, either very pro-life or very abortion advocacy, any challenge to those beliefs can be very, very difficult. So hearing new evidence or hearing new information can kind of put up some really strong barriers. So we're not in the business of converting people's thinking. We're not in the business of trying to change an abortion advocate's mind. We're in the business of providing accurate, up-to-date, research-based evidence and providing a platform for women's lived experiences so that that information can help inform people's views and experiences. What I'd like to ask you to do tonight is, regardless of your personal ideology, so regardless of whether you very strongly believe abortion should never be available and no woman should ever think about it and she should never even consider it and shouldn't ever have one, or whether you sit on the polar end of that camp and think it should be available on demand and every woman should have one to feel empowered about herself, which, you know, is something that lots of abortion advocates say. It's a really good idea if you can kind of just put that aside for just, you know, the next half an hour to hear some facts, to hear what it is really like for some women who live through this experience. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some facts and figures, and then I'm going to give you three very, very typical stories of post-abortive women. Thanks, Kate. So first of all, when we talk about unintended pregnancy, people often think unintended pregnancy is automatically perhaps a bit of a disaster for a woman, a real crisis, and maybe quite unusual. In 2009, there were just under 300,000 births in Australia, and around half of those births began as an unintended pregnancy. So half of all pregnancies are unintended. The other half are, you know, intended or planned for, or perhaps not considered unintended, but, you know, perhaps a happy event. Around half of those unintended pregnancies end in abortion. So with unintended pregnancy being very common, we need to kind of rethink about whether it's unintendedness that actually creates a conflict for women. And the fact that 50% of women with experiencing an unintended pregnancy continue their pregnancies, that tells us that it's not really about unintendedness or wantedness. The other issue this raises, of course, particularly with abortion advocates, is that this means we need better access to contraception. We need better access to abortion, we need better access to contraception. However, Marie Stopes International, who is one of the world's biggest abortion providers, did their own research in Australia in 2008, and they found that 60% of women with an unintended pregnancy were already using contraception, some of them more than one. They were being extra super duper careful, and they still fell pregnant. So we know that access to contraception and the use of contraception doesn't always mean that women aren't going to get pregnant and then face whatever the circumstances are with regards to that. I want to talk briefly about the law. This is really important because there's been a lot of talk about taking abortion out of the criminal code in different states, and I want to talk to you about how that kind of does and doesn't really matter. Abortion remains in the criminal code in all but the ACT and Victoria in Australia. This fact does not limit the availability of abortion to women in any way. And I can demonstrate that by talking about what happened in 2009 in Victoria after any restriction on abortion was lifted. So arguments about the legality of abortion in relation to its access really are a bit of a distraction. It doesn't really matter. What we do know, though, when we talk about legal issues surrounding abortion and we look at what did happen in Victoria, is that with or without legal protections around abortion, there really is no protection for women from coerced abortion, and there is no protection for our children from having abortions either, that their parents don't know about. In every state except for Western Australia, minors can have abortions without parents being notified or having to give their consent. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that shortly as well. Even with abortion in the criminal code, it is more freely available to a broader range of women and children than any other surgical or medical procedure in the country. So it being in the criminal code is not hurting those for whom, you know, those who are saying they need abortion access. In 2009, which is the year after the legislative changes in Victoria, there were around 17,000 terminations. Now, I'm using the most conservative figures I can find. I don't want to be accused of exaggerating abortion figures. We're better off erring on the side of conservative. And so I've taken these figures from family planning. So they've estimated the numbers from Medicare item numbers. That means about 19.3% of all pregnancies in Victoria were aborted. In New South Wales in the same year, where it remained in the criminal code, about 21.1% of pregnancies were aborted. So you can see that what that means is that abortion being in the criminal code in New South Wales really did nothing to limit women's access. We do need to be careful about Medicare item numbers if you're ever looking at that, because sometimes they are multi-use. In Victoria, abortion is available on demand for for any reason, meaning no reason needs to be given, up to 24 weeks of gestation. Between 24 weeks of gestation up until the time a woman really goes into labour, so up until the time of birth, a woman can get can have an abortion really for any reason, but she needs the consent of two doctors. Now, one would think that's an added protection, but in actual fact, the woman doesn't need to see the two doctors. She only needs to see one doctor, who needs to ring a colleague to say, these are the circumstances, do you think this is appropriate? And it can be a colleague who works in the same facility. So it's not really an added protection. The practice of abortion, this is the one I didn't have, legal inconsistencies. Just very quickly, with minors, particularly in Victoria, I'm more familiar with the abortion, with the other laws in Victoria. But in Victoria, your 15-year-old can be walk into an abortion clinic, have an abortion, and you never need to know about it. But they're not allowed to get their ears pierced unless you write them a letter or take them to the salon. They're not allowed to get a tattoo, even if they're 17, and you walk to the tattoo parlour with them and you beg them, I just really want him to have mum written, you know, on the arm. They're not allowed to give your 17-year-old a tattoo, even if you're asking for it. They're not allowed to go to a solarium and get a fake suntan, because they're really not responsible enough till they're 18 to make those kinds of autonomous decisions about their own bodies. But they can have an abortion without you even knowing. This is in spite of the fact that we know that about 30% of teenage girls talk about experiencing coerced sex. So they're often having sex against their will, and maybe falling pregnant and then having abortions, and you as a parent have no right to know that your child's even been in harm's way. But they can't do these other things. You know, there's an incredible amount of inconsistency in the law surrounding abortion. 95% of all abortions are undertaken for psychosocial reasons. Psychosocial reasons means economics, other social reasons such as housing, jobs, job security, wanting to finish an education, relationship issues. About 15% of all abortions occur in the setting of domestic violence as well. Only a very small proportion of abortions are undertaken for either health reasons of the mother, and I'll be addressing that in a little bit, congenital abnormality, or the other issue that people often raise is issues of sexual assault. We won't be addressing that one too much tonight. Unless someone has a question, I'm perfectly happy to talk about it for a while. More than 50% of post-20-week abortions are also for psychosocial reasons. Now, most people don't know that that's the case. Most people believe that late-term abortions only occur in the most dire of circumstances, when the baby's going to die anyway or mum's at death's door, and the only thing we can do is do an abortion to save her life. I'm going to talk about that in just one moment. When I talk about psychosocial reasons, I don't want to minimise the experiences of women who feel like their only choice is abortion. I'm not trying to say that because a woman says, I don't have enough money, or I don't have somewhere to live, or I really need to finish my education, that for that woman it's not serious. I believe for those women those things are very serious. We do need to have some perspective about what those issues are and how they could be better addressed. Some of the reasons that women give are very complex. It's rarely just one thing, and these are some of them. Not enough support, not enough money, nowhere to live, I don't feel mature enough. Who feels mature enough to have a child? My eldest is 30, and I'm still not mature enough. So I'm not quite sure how that works. I can't leave my job. I want to finish my education. My partner wants me to have an abortion. I don't want to be a single mother, or in the face of domestic violence. Most women have more than one reason. Most women give an average 4.7 reasons for wanting to have an abortion when they have to be asked a reason, where reasons are recorded. In South Australia, they do record reasons. For women who consider late-term abortions, the reasons can be even more complex. Around half the women having post-20-week abortions they're dealing with a possible or confirmed congenital abnormality of their unborn. These abnormalities range from being more minor surgically correctable cleft palate, right through to something, a condition that might be incompatible with life or that may require extensive care. So it runs right across the spectrum. There are between 2 and 3, so about 2.7, post 20-week abortions being carried out every working day of the week. So whilst we say it's only about 3% of abortions, or 3 to 5% of abortions in the post 20-week period, it's about 3 a day. So that kind of makes it a bit more real. So today, since I got up and got on a plane this morning, right through to tonight, there's been, you know, 2 late-term abortions post 20 weeks. Half of those were on healthy unborn of healthy mothers. So they were for psychosocial reasons, reasons that may have been able to be addressed by other than surgical solutions. We're going to talk about why those things don't happen. In this next table, which you can probably see reasonably well up there, this shows the breakdown of psychosocial versus congenital abnormality abortions in Victoria since they started keeping records. It's very easy for us to extrapolate the figures now, but you had to kind of be, you know, really dive into the figures in the earlier days. But you can see in 2009, there were 410 late post 20-week abortions. It jumped from 328 the year before when the legislation changed. In that year, 214 of them were for psychosocial indications. 10 of those were post 28 weeks. So 10 women with some kind of social or emotional circumstance at 28 weeks pregnant plus were given a surgical solution to their social or emotional problem. That's 10, that's a lot. At 28 weeks, most babies can be delivered and provided care. I don't actually know how much for whether they were 32 weeks or 34 weeks or 36 weeks. Those sorts of figures are harder to come by. So it's really important to understand that. It's really important to understand that because when you're talking about this issue, when you're talking about women's needs, and often what you get is the arguments about, well, we need to have abortion because, you know, women need, you know, babies might die and people only have late-term abortions if they're about to die, et cetera, et cetera. That's not true. And these figures are consistent across the other states as well. In Queensland and in South Australia, where the figures are kept, half of the late-term abortions are for psychosocial reasons, even though the law says these abortions can only occur when the woman's life is in some peril. So that can also mean her mental health, which can simply mean she has nowhere to live. Thanks, Kate. So abortion is sold as a necessary means to women's reproductive freedom, without which women are limited in education, career and relationship choices. And for many women, these limits absolutely exist. The fact of abortion availability hasn't made women's choices any easier. What it's done is make it easier for us as a society to not have to address the real needs of women. Workplaces are not being forced to provide more flexible work practices and childcare. Universities are not being forced to provide better on-campus childcare. I still talk to uni students today who were denied being able to take their nursing baby into a lecture. Or, you know, were denied, an extension on something because they'd had a sick child. So these things all happen today. We don't have to address those things whilst abortion is so available. I saw a tweet. Who twitters? Anyone Twitter? Yes, I saw a tweet. A tweet is a thing that goes out there with 144 characters. It's very frustrating for someone who has many more characters than that to speak a day, I can tell you. But I saw a tweet from a very prominent abortion advocate in Australia the other day. She'd been watching the US elections, obviously, and Romney had talked about the creating many jobs for women. And her tweet was, all well and good, Romney, but how will women take these jobs if you deny them access to abortion? And I thought that says everything about, that says everything that I feel about this whole thing to do with abortion. What it says is that women are still being forced to choose. You know, the feminist movement began about letting women have the choice of both being married and being in the workforce, of, you know, being at home or being in the workforce, being paid a fair wage. We've just exchanged one form of bondage to a different form of bondage, but abortion advocates do not see it in that way, and they do not see the dissonance and the conflicting messages in what they're putting out. The stories that abortion advocates put forward as evidence that women need abortion are the same stories we put forward that illustrate the ways in which we're failing women. A pregnant homeless woman might need an abortion, or she might need somewhere to live. A drug-addicted prostitute might need an abortion, or she might need rehab and a bit of support to get back up on her feet. A 22-year-old university student, exactly the same thing. She might need an abortion, or she might need a way to, you know, flex her studies a little bit. A 34-year-old woman, I hear this one constantly, abused by her husband. She's already got four children at home. Of course she has to have an abortion or her husband's going to bash her up. Well, maybe she needs a way out. You know, maybe there are other things that we can do for her. Those things don't need to be addressed because abortion is the default position, even for married women who attend their GP with excitement, having done a home pregnancy test and say, I'm pregnant and I'm here for my first visit. I hear from doctors all the time that they feel compelled to say, so are you planning to keep it? Would you like fries with that? That's what it's become. And I hear that even from Christian pro-life doctors, that they feel enormous pressure. Thanks, Kate. So should we accept that abortion is the best solution we can offer women to the social, educational and professional obstacles? I can't accept that. I don't want to accept that. And I don't want to be telling other women that they should accept that. I'm going to just quickly run through three quick stories for you. One, a university student, one who had a quick fix, one, a married woman, and one woman with a diagnosed congenital abnormality. And you make up your mind how much coercion was or wasn't involved in these stories, and how much informed consent was or wasn't applied. Sandra, next, thank you. Sandra sent her story into our new website, which is iregretmyabortion.org.au, if you haven't visited it. The abortion advocates don't like it and sent like hundreds of people to it by tweeting about how bad it was. We've never been so busy. I'm sure if they knew the publicity we were getting from them telling the world how terrible we are, they wouldn't be doing it. What happened to Sandra was she suspected she might be pregnant. You can read her full story on the website, so I won't go over the whole thing, but she thought she might be pregnant after a casual fling. And she kind of let things go. It was exam time. She was a bit nervous. She thought she might be sick with nerves, etc., etc. So she hadn't done anything about it. It was still at the middle of exam time. She told a friend who said, why don't you go and see the school, the campus nurse, which she did. So she went to see the campus nurse one day, who said, that's okay, we can take care of this for you today. She made a phone call, the nurse made a phone call to the local abortion clinic, said to Sandra, here's a list of what you need to take with you, which includes the standard, you know, change of underwear, sanitary napkin, your Medicare card and this much cash. And you go down there and they're going to take care of everything for you today. So Sandra did what she was told and she gathered her supplies and she went down to the abortion facility. She says, they didn't really ask me any questions, except they did say I'd nearly left it too late for it to be simple. I felt a bit stupid, so immediately she felt kind of reprimanded when they said I was apparently nearly 10 weeks gone and I didn't have a clue. So they're telling her she's silly for not getting there in time. or earlier. They asked me if I was sure I wanted to have the pregnancy ended, and I just thought, well, of course I do. Nobody said the word abortion. I signed a paper giving permission, sat around for an hour or so, and then went in. I don't really remember much. There were a few people standing around. I was a bit embarrassed. Only one person really spoke to me. I'm not sure if it was the doctor. I don't really know which one was the doctor. That's her recollection. That night she attended the emergency room of her local hospital because she was very worried about the amount of bleeding that she had and some cramping. And the nurse said to her, the nurse asked her what had happened, and Sandra explained that I've been to a clinic today because I was pregnant. And the nurse said, so you've had an abortion. And Sandra says, she didn't say it in a bad way, not like she meant anything by it. She was just asking me, but I couldn't speak. I felt really confused. Nobody had said abortion, and I realised that's what I did. I had an abortion. We kind of think, well, at 22, you know, how could you kind of just not think about that? That was her experience. So she then goes on to talk about the fact that she hadn't really thought about that and what that then meant to her and what the rest of her year was like, and you can read a lot of those details. She goes on to say, I wish I could say someone forced me, but I can't say that at all. I'm not an idiot, but I truly just wasn't thinking. I find it hard to believe that something so big could happen to a person and they don't even recognise it. Do I regret it? I don't know, she says, as she's typing her story for our website. I imagine that I could have had a baby right now, and that makes me really sad. I guess I wish that I felt like I'd made a decision, but I don't. I feel angry about that. She talks about drinking a lot during the year. Goes on to say, I had an abortion. I didn't have a nose job. I had an abortion and now I'm not holding a baby. Do I regret it? Yes, I think I do. Most of all, I wish I'd understood it. So she's really dealing with a whole lot of confusion. Rebecca was 24 years old, married, pregnant with a tried-for baby. So a young Catholic married girl. Her and her husband had been trying for a year and a half. He left her for another woman. 2 weeks later, she found out she was pregnant. She was delighted because she thought that perhaps this is why he left, because we couldn't have a baby. Now I'm pregnant, I'll call him, I'll tell him, and he'll come home. He didn't come home. She started getting harassing phone calls from the girlfriend saying, you know, you have to do him a favour and get rid of it. He rang and said, you have to have an abortion. Her very well-meaning, well-intended, caring, genuinely caring family said, you don't want to be tied to him for the rest of your life. Look what he's done to you. You know, you're much better off to have a fresh start. You should have an abortion. Rebecca did not want an abortion. She took an overdose of paracetamol one night and then got really scared and rang her sister and said, I've done something stupid. You better take me to the hospital. She went down to the hospital where she was told at the clinic that she was really stupid. Now she'll have to have an abortion because she's probably damaged her baby, right? Which is not really accurate information either. So 2 days later, she had her sister ring and, thank you, make the appointment for her at the local abortion clinic. This was in Albury. Rebecca said all she remembered was waking up in the morning and crying. She cried the whole morning until her sister picked her up. She cried as she got out of the car, as she walked into the facility. The only thing she remembers about the consultation was being asked, is this what you want to do? And Rebecca replied, I don't know what else to do. She said, I cried the whole time I waited. She was one of the first to go in. She thought she was one of the first to go in because she couldn't stop crying and she was told she might be upsetting other people. She cried as she got on the table. She doesn't remember anything about the procedure except that she woke up crying. She left the place crying and she hadn't stopped crying when she came to see me 3 weeks later. What she said was, I never stopped crying once. And she talked me through all of that. I haven't stopped crying since. I can't ever sleep. I keep hearing a baby cry. I don't know how this could have happened to me. I really wanted that baby. A week after she had this abortion, one of her colleagues excitedly announced her pregnancy, exactly the same weeks of pregnancy that Rebecca would have been. And she knew that she then had to work alongside this woman as this progressed. So we need to ask ourselves, certainly as a health professional, having worked in a variety of settings, including I've worked in theatre, I've worked in oncology, I've worked in mental health. If I was in theatre, or if I was, you know, transporting someone to theatre who was crying and crying and crying and crying, and I was saying, are you sure this is what you want? And they're saying, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. I would not push that trolley one step further. I'd be ripping up those consent forms. I'd be saying to the doctor, this woman needs to be reconsented. She needs to be talked to. We need to go through this process. And that would be for something, you know, less significant than an abortion, in my thinking anyway. But these stories are not uncommon. What about congenital abnormality? These account for around 3% of all abortions, about 3% of abortions each year. And we talked about the broad spectrum of ways in which these happen. Sadly, sometimes, even when a woman does everything she can to seek out alternatives, the push toward abortion as the best solution is so strong that everyone overlooks her need for different answers. Simone was 22 weeks pregnant with a long-awaited second child. Her first child was 2.5. A routine ultrasound shows that her baby has a bladder problem. That's how she describes it to me. Her and her husband do everything right. They travel to Melbourne and talk to a paediatric specialist at the Royal Children's Hospital. He gives them the worst case scenario. Simone's recollection of the worst case scenario was being told that your husband will probably leave you, because marriages rarely survive the kinds of things that will have to happen here. You won't get custody of your 2.5-year-old because you'll be so busy travelling backwards and forwards to the hospital or having to stay here. So it's really unfair to your husband, it's unfair to your extended family who'll be stuck taking care of your 2.5-year-old, and it's mostly unfair to your current child. It's a really selfish decision to have this baby, and it's selfish for that baby. Do you really want that baby to go through this? That's her recollection of the information she received. He tells her, and her husband says, he doesn't want this for their child, their current child. Her mother says, really, you have to think about, you know, you're 2.5-year-old. You can't think about the baby. You have to think about the child that you've already got. Simone's referred to a second gynecologist who is the gynecologist who will do the termination. She's not really thinking that that's the case. She's 23 weeks and 3 days pregnant. This is prior to the law changing. She asks this gynecologist for more information about what's wrong with her baby. This gynecologist tells her she doesn't know, but assures her she's probably doing the right thing. I'm just here to talk to you about the termination. Now, at this time, it wasn't possible to have an abortion after 24 weeks without it going to the ethics committee in the particular hospital she was in. So she was told that she would have to be scheduled for 2 days' time. Otherwise, we'll have to go to the ethics committee, then the media probably finds out, then everyone knows. So we need to get it over with. That's what she was presented with. So Simone reluctantly goes into the maternity ward for labour induction. She says to the midwife, do you think I should do this? And the midwife says, it's not my place to judge you. I'm sure you've made the right choice. Simone is desperate. She's looking everywhere for some answers. She says, everywhere I went, I kept expecting someone to talk to me about what I wanted to do. Every doctor I went to, when I arrived at the hospital, nobody did. They all just said, this is the best thing. It's your decision. Someone even told me it would be selfish to do anything else, but I didn't really know what anything else would be, because no one told her what anything else would be. No one said, hey, this is also an option. Not one person. Simone delivered a baby boy who she described as so perfect. She looked at him and there was nothing wrong with him in her eyes. You know, she just saw this perfect baby and she believed he was breathing. She said, I saw him breathing, and I said, he's breathing, help him. But they just took him away from me and said, no, he's not. So we don't actually know if that baby formed one of the statistics of babies, you know, that come under this category of born alive in Victoria, for which we have all those numbers as well. The reason Simone came to see me was at the request of her mother, who rang me, and initially she didn't say that Simone had had a termination. She said she'd lost a baby, and it was some talking through how those things had come about that we came to discover what had occurred. She'd spent the previous 2 months, not able to look at, care for, touch, cuddle her 2.5-year-old daughter. Because her 2.5-year-old daughter was the reason everyone said she had to have an abortion. And she kept saying, I couldn't help thinking, if I didn't have her, I'd still have my baby boy. And in her mind, it was all her little girl's fault. It was, the whole reason everyone said have an abortion, to protect and nurture and mother and keep caring for your current child, she just simply could not do after having this abortion. She goes, and I encouraged her to go back to her GP to ask a few questions. And she said, when I asked my GP why nobody suggested I could have the baby, she said it was because nobody else would have had the baby. Everyone else would have had an abortion. And she said, I just felt stupid. Am I the only one who wouldn't have had an abortion? I told her they wouldn't if they knew how it felt. That particular GP still refers many women for abortion in my local area. Each of these women said they made a choice. Even though I could probably argue a fairly convincing case that for every one of these women there was coercion or misinformation or deception involved, every one of them believes it was their choice. That's how effectively women have brought the message, that it's all about their choice. Even when they're not making it, they believe they're making it. None of them felt they had an alternative, and all of them were only offered one option. The evidence of harm from abortion is enormous. There are dozens and dozens of published studies demonstrating adverse risks of abortion. Most women do not receive any of this information. But there are risks of mental health problems, premature delivery of subsequent children, attachment issues. We just had a prime example in that story. An increased risk of death from all causes, including accidents, homicide and suicide. Even though abortion clinics today in our country market their services by saying abortion is 8, 11 or even 100 times safer than childbirth. That flies in the face of every bit of evidence that we have, but they're allowed to tell a woman whose one fear might be childbirth that, in fact, abortion's much safer. It's 11 times safer than continuing a pregnancy. That is actually a lie. With 20% of women suffering serious and prolonged mental health harm following abortion, including depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, alcohol and drug abuse, the costs to women personally, let alone to their families, to their workplaces, to their ability to be educated, and to our communities is not insignificant. The very reasons we say women should have access to all these abortions so that they can participate to their fullest potential, for 20% of those women, it removes all of that potential from them. And very, very few, very few are ever informed that this is a possibility. In fact, the evidence, as substantial as it is, continues to be denied by abortion advocates. In my experience in health, if there was even a tiny risk or even a possible risk, you'd let the patient know. Let them, even if there was a bit of dispute, you'd say, well, look, some people think this, others don't, but we need to give you that information. Abortion is not like anything else in terms of the rules that are applied. No other surgical procedure is as easily available. Informed consent processes are woefully inadequate. There are no documented health benefits from abortion. I have searched every database, spoken to every expert I know in the world, now I know world people, and there is no research that documents a health benefit to women from abortion. In countries where abortion is illegal, where we've seen studies, like in Chile, where abortion used to be legal and then it wasn't legal, we see better maternal outcomes in women. Because, of course, if we don't say abortion is the default position, we're going to have to take care of pregnant women, aren't we? We're going to have to help them have their children. We're going to have to make sure they're healthy. We're going to have to help them participate more fully. So we have to put those resources in. And the negative experiences of women are being silenced. We're finding that very strongly at the moment, dealing with some of the abortion advocates who are having flash mobs around the country. You've seen the stuff about flash mobs? They have dance parties celebrating abortion in the streets. They are talking about, one in particular is talking about abortion being so mundane that it's like sneezing. And we don't ask women if they sneezed recently, do we?
on the same, you know, and it's the most common surgical procedure. It shouldn't even be talked about. There shouldn't be stigma. There shouldn't be shame. And I'm not saying there should be stigma and shame, but what they're saying is that it's our work. It's the work of people who genuinely care about women and who try to get this information out that's making women feel ashamed, when in actual fact it's like a sneeze. Shouldn't even be considered. Abortion advocates argue that to suggest women require counselling, waiting periods, or more comprehensive information about their alternatives is patronising and takes away their rights. I counselled in my private practice earlier this year a woman whose brother killed himself, having just been diagnosed with Huntington's disease. It was found to run in their family, and she wanted to be genetically tested. She had to go through 6 months of genetic counselling. She had to travel to Melbourne to see a psychiatrist before they would agree to take her blood. She didn't want to have a procedure done. She wanted a blood test to find out if she carried Huntington's disease. Now, if telling a woman that she has to come back the next day for her abortion, or telling a woman that she might suffer some harm, or that she has to explore these alternatives is patronising, what is it? If you want to have your blood taken, you've got to see 3 psychiatrists to get a blood test. You know, again, there is such incongruence here in the way these things are talked about. Cancer treatments, cosmetic surgery, removal of cataracts, you know, getting into your GP, I've got to wait 7 weeks to see my GP unless I ring with my finger on redial at 8:30 every morning to try and get the only emergency appointment that might be available that day. How could it have been patronising to suggest that Sandra take some material home with her and talk to her campus about what other options might be available and come back the next day? Doesn't even have to interrupt the business of abortion. They just have to kind of reshuffle their schedules. They see all the women in the morning, and in the afternoon they see the women from yesterday morning to do their abortions. They can still keep them rolling in, but except for the fact that they know that if a woman goes away to consider her options, she may not come back. Nobody can tell me that that is not about the business of selling abortion as opposed to the business of caring for women. Fear is really blinding, and this is what we're up against. Abortion was so hard fought for. Abortion advocates have a lot invested in abortion being right. I have never expressed judgment on any woman who has thought about or had an abortion. I don't express judgment toward and don't feel it toward those who strongly advocate for abortion either. When you think about it, anyone who is pushing abortion that hard must have a heavy emotional investment in its rightness. And I know when my really strongly held values are challenged, you kind of have this immediate, that can't be right. Now, when you think about it, if you have a strongly held value that abortion has to be okay because you had one, or you took your girlfriend there to have one, or you encouraged someone to have one, the very idea that maybe there's something not quite right with it could be very, very difficult to come to terms with. So we do need to tread very gently. We're not in the business of converting hardcore abortion advocates. We're not in the business of converting anyone. We're in the business of providing education so that all those fence sitters can stop saying, well, I wouldn't have an abortion, but all those women should be able to choose. They need to know those women aren't choosing. What we need to do is make sure that people understand that today, the only difference for women than in the 60s is that then they may not have been getting so much money, or they may have had to choose to be married or have their jobs, because I know that happened. Today we're saying you have to choose your pregnancy or your career, your pregnancy or your education. Those things don't have to be true. I don't believe they are true. I do believe we have lots of structures in place in order to support women. It was my experience as a 17-year-old mum, you know, who later had another baby at 20 and was divorced and you know, went back to uni and got then ended up with 3 degrees. And I've got a 30-year-old daughter now. I've got grandchildren who are wonderful, productive members of society with minimal support. You know, it's possible to do it. There was nothing special about my circumstance. There was nothing special or unique or particularly, supportive about my environment. You don't need a lot. All you need is one person to say, you know, we'll help you. We'll stand by you. This is okay to do this, and it's possible, but that's not what we're telling women. Thank you.
Disagree with Debbie about, and that is to say that she isn't anyone special. I think she's showing an enormous leadership and energy that is particularly special, if we can use that term. I thought that I would respond very briefly to Debbie's excellent presentation. There are so many facts, and I know Jovina's going to have some other important information from a medical perspective. So what I thought I'd do is just try to think of about six important areas, that important aspects of making a decision that make a choice real. Because I think part of one of the most powerful things in Debbie's presentation was the fact that what is presented as a choice is actually highly incongruent with a decision in anyone's moral compass. In fact, the moral compass is thrown away by society when we talk about this type of decision. We're not using the same compass that we would use, as Debbie's already pointed out, in any other field of medicine, let alone in any other major life-changing decision in their lives. So let me think of the six different things that I think are particularly important. Now, this one's a really 101 for ethics decision point. A decision needs to be adequately informed. Now, that seems so obvious, doesn't it? But it is not obvious, and it is not recognised in the decision surrounding pregnancy. Ethical decisions of this nature are always taken on a wider screen than simply what is the most acceptable outcome. We don't make decisions simply on buying a house by saying, was it an acceptable outcome and stop there? It's a dynamic, ongoing, existential experience buying the sort of house that you buy. And we need to think about decisions like this in depth and breadth and in length. So people considering important and often difficult decisions need to think about the rightness and wrongness of a particular action, yes, but also about other kinds of questions as well. What sort of person am I? What does it mean for me to be a mother? What attitudes and beliefs do I live by? And how do I apply these to this aspect of my life? And these are all sorts of questions that are associated with character and virtue, things which Dr. Sandy knows a lot about, and about our relationships, about what we believe, what things we value the most. But you don't see these issues being brought up when a woman presents with a problem or unintended pregnancy. Those considerations are actually sped up so quickly that no one has time to think about these, and I think Debbie's illustrated that perfectly. One interesting factor is that in relation to being confronted with a complex pregnancy-related question, there is often a discrepancy between the weight and interpretation of data that is presented to the woman or couple than it is from the perspective of the healthcare professional. So the way the healthcare professional presenting the data sees the data is very, very different from the way the couple hear that data. I think Debbie's given us lots of illustrations of that as well. So one serious question about how well informed you are is how accessible is the information? What does it mean to you? Quite often women, and there was a glaring example of that in the Simone case, she didn't even have a concept for the action that she was being asked to take. So you can hardly call it an informed choice. Accessibility is a central issue here. And being given a list of statistics, for example, even statistics that may be true in a certain sense, may mean that the data is very reductive. For instance, we all see in the Herald Sun down in Melbourne figures of how much it costs to have a baby over the whole lifetime of your life. Enough to send you into a panic attack. You know, how many millions of dollars does it... I'm the oldest of 11 children, and my poor father used to occasionally say, I think I've bought another dairy herd today. But the way that information is presented matters, and the way it's presented has a major influence on the way the woman hears that information. Interestingly, in a study done of prenatal screening, studies on prenatal screening, it was found that over 78% of papers argued that the information being given to women did not adequately inform the subjects of those series. 78 studies have found inadequate informing. In other words, the information was not meaningful, it was not adequate, there was no freedom given to time or consideration. Now, one reason for that is that quite often healthcare professionals are working out of a different framework to the couple or to the woman. And as someone rightly said, there are a whole lot of other important values going on in the healthcare professional's world. Fear of liability being one. I can see Javina nodding vigorously to that one. Little genetic training, so a fear even of the statistics they're presenting to the person. Time constraints. We all know, I think Debbie's illustrated, the panic button. Sometimes people talk about moral panic, but this is serious moral panic. It's panic where you're not even allowed to be moral. And also the practice of directiveness. I ought to know what to do. I'm in this position as a doctor. I ought to have a solution. I should have an outcome. A utilitarian framework, even if the doctor, when that doctor clocks off, he or she lives by a totally other set of values and a totally different ethical framework. So often people, Debbie spoke about a doctor who, a healthcare setting that might even be Christian in its outlook, but have adopted a utilitarian outlook. And this is a problem that we see in Catholic hospitals as well. And in question time, we can talk a little bit about that. So when a couple or a woman are given completely different and a deeper set of possibilities about a choice, for instance, about the availability of real and concrete perinatal palliative care when they're told about a child who has a serious genetic disability, even one that's called incompatible with life. Now, I heard one woman who was told this, your baby has a condition incompatible with life, and she said, oh, is the baby dead? The word didn't make sense to her. If it's incompatible with life, does that mean the baby's not alive? And it took her about 3 days. She didn't choose to terminate, but she was imagining the baby had already died. And she kept asking, is the baby dead? No, but it might as well be. So can you see how we've just got a miscommunication, and as Debbie has said, I think also a deception, whether intentional or not. And it was interesting that in a study done on discussions with couples and women who were given information about this idea of palliative care for life-threatening conditions in their unborn child, their considerations shifted from a view of tragedy, which was undoubtedly how they first heard the news, to an emphasis upon how they could plan in terms of bringing their family together, the quality of the short time they would have with their baby and with his or her relatives, and a personalisation about the experience of birth. 40, and in one study, 80% said they would keep their baby once they were told, a very important piece of information that extended their way of envisaging their options. We also know that no message is neutral. And it seems, and as Debbie's illustrated perfectly, a lot of data in the way that it's presented is coercive. Now, to say to somebody, oh, it's not my decision, but you've made a best decision, is to actually pull the tablecloth from under somebody's freedom, isn't it? To say, I'm not going to impose my decision on you, but you've made the best decision. Now, I know from women who have been faced with this type of discussion with healthcare professionals that they, in the end, develop a kind of compassion for the healthcare person. They say, I understand why they did that. They wanted to make me feel better about terminating. They did it out of a misplaced compassion, not recognising that as medical professionals, their decisions, their way of communicating actually carried weight. We don't live in an ethical level playing field when we come to healthcare decisions. For instance, in Victoria, in the Victorian legislation, the word emergency is one such term. In other words, under the Victorian law, abortion law, a nurse or a chemist is told that they cannot conscientiously object to abortion in an emergency setting. What does that mean? That's a constructed term that's part of the moral panic button that's pushed when we come to making decisions about pregnancy. So that's the first thing. Inform people and be aware that information is not neutral. Secondly, the context in which the person makes the decision. Now, all of us make decisions, and most of these are made within the context of our relationships and cultures. There are particular roles that people take in helping us make decisions or with whom we bounce ideas off. We know we do this every day, and again, Debbie's already spoken about this. But the familiar and common setting in which women make decisions about pregnancy, either to continue or to terminate, is that of being alone. The idea of a cast iron space, impenetrable to light, impenetrable to the notion of normative value, or the contribution of others, almost exists in no other realm of our lives except in decisions about pregnancy. This means that once a pregnancy is understood to be difficult, or even unexpected, it means that the woman is sent into a neutral isolation ward, where she must make an individual choice, and she better do it smartly. Here, neither her sexual partner, or more seriously, her spouse, or her advisors, or her wider community may dare to step. An Italian Catholic writer who had been, I think, pro-choice at one stage writes, Eugenia Rocella writes, "Being left alone materially and morally is one of the most serious violations against the dignity of women and of the child, and is tangible evidence of the failure of solidarity that is meant to be the basis of social coexistence." Alistair McIntyre writes that this is a radically different ethical context from the one in which people live in traditional or communal societies, where sometimes the challenge is to find privacy, but certainly not this converse problem, which tends to freeze both time and relationships until this precious choice is made. So total isolation, almost in one of those sort of bubble wards, isolation wards. No one's allowed to enter into there and interject, except the system itself, which slowly pushes a person towards the termination. One ethical writer, Barbara Katz Rothman, describes evocatively the suspension in time and existential development which allows us to pass through and beyond a crisis. Debbie would be very familiar with this. When we first face a crisis, we usually say, "I cannot cope," don't we? That's the way we face crisis. "I can't do it, I can't face it." But time, the support of others, imagination, thought, usually gets us to get out of bed in the morning, and it gets us to resolve and face the problem, and we are happy at the end of the day that we did face that challenge. She called the obverse situation the condition of a tentative pregnancy. In other words, when you are in a surprise pregnancy, you're not allowed to admit that you're pregnant. You have to actually put it into suspended animation. So the usual way we cope with crisis is to imagine our way out of it, to think our way out of it, and to relate to others to get support on the way out of it. But in the case of, say, prenatal testing, we're not allowed to do that. It has to be made quickly and promptly without anyone interfering, this notion of a sort of isolation ward. In addition to that, the landscape of being a mother has been shattered by social upheaval, the loosenings of tradition of shared belief, and the effects of technology, be that virtual reality or the rise of reproductive measures of human reproduction. As many philosophers note well, including Alistair McIntyre, the meaning of kinship bonds are very different. What does it mean to be an aunt or a grandmother, he would ask. More noticeably, how does it now mean, what does it mean to be a spouse or a father? What's the expectation of that? And again, when we're talking about pregnancy, women say, "I can't do that to my mother. I can't do that to my auntie." In other words, I can't expect them to play the role they once supported in supporting me. And as Debbie, I think, has pointed out, in not doing that, we're not making opportunities for women to find support. So in other words, we're not demanding enough. We're not making our social network and our kinship demanding enough. And isn't it interesting that we now invent shadowy, functional, non-kinship and non-conventional, non-covenantal relationships, such as friends with benefits, what does that mean? You notice that this term is a highly utilitarian one, not one based on kinship or covenant. We've spoken a little bit about the complexity of moral freedom. I don't think I need to say too much more there, but to say that the notion of freedom applied to pregnancy decisions is utterly different from that of having plastic surgery, and I think Debbie has spoken about that with far more colour and vigour than I could. The fourth element that I think we need to imagine here is that of imagination. moral imagination. The Canadian-Australian ethicist Margaret Somerville encourages us to allow imagination into our ethical decisions, both as a society and in our relationships. All journeys of our imagination and our shared collective imagination allow us to make wise decisions about ethics, spirituality, personal narrative, and even about the direction of science. Since imagination is crucial in all these realms and in decision-making, do you notice how little imagination is allowed into the decision about pregnancy? There is no space for a person to be able to think through the facts that they're given. So there's an imagination shut down. The fifth thing I want to identify as a problem in pregnancy decisions is recognising, in an existential sense, the complexity of one particular experience, and that is pregnancy itself. Pregnancy is still mysterious. It's puzzling. Even for healthcare professionals, it's scary in lots of ways. And again, if I can quote the Italian philosopher, feminist philosopher, she says, "Sometimes maternity is not only a joyful experience. It carries fear with it, at times depression and rejection, because it implies contact with the sacred and the elsewhere, with that that transcends us and which we cannot control, but only welcome. In the experience of birth, there is an interior sense of limit, even in terms of sentiments. Maternal omnipotence accepts little by little, letting itself be disarmed and powerless." And I think any mother in the room will say, contra Murray Stopes, you cannot plan a child. You can help them with their education, you can map out things that will help them, but you cannot have, their motto is a planned child is a happy child. There's no such thing as a planned child. There's a person, but not a planned child. So I think the rhetoric that we use there gives us, completely makes one-dimensional, in an outcome utilitarian sense, the very rich, complex, and sometimes ambiguous experience of pregnancy. Many women who are in happy relationships, when they discover that they are pregnant by surprise, go through a myriad of different emotional responses. If you were to ask them one day what they felt about did they want to be pregnant, they might say no. But as Debbie's already illustrated, that does not equate to the decision to have a termination. It just means, I don't think I want to be in this place. Again, it's one of those challenging ethical situations that we need to work through, journey through, in that great sense of the word experience. The last thing I wanted to think is contribute to this discussion is to say, the thing that's really left out of the abortion debate is the need to realise that human beings fail. I mean, how many ways can I say this? We do the wrong thing, we sin. However, whichever ethical framework you're using, we get it wrong. Feeling distress that some of our actions and decisions are regrettable and even morally and socially harmful is not a sign of moral backwardness or oppression, but a sign of maturity. Not to do regret is to be monstrous. As Leon Cass would say, not to say I did the wrong thing. And yet, in every other area of social life, we demand sorry days, rightly, regret, penitence, but not about this. And as Debbie has also said, we're not allowed to even say that it's regrettable, even in a small way. Not a chink of regret is to be entered into in this ideological decision. So it's not even allowed to appear in the literature. And this is extraordinary. So it also means this also creates a situation in women who do genuinely feel regret and all kinds of other experiences of grief, guilt, sorrow, are silenced, have nowhere to go with their story. There is no politically or morally acceptable way to face the fact that I could have done otherwise, and this also prevents the door to healing. Melinda Tankard-Reist, along with Debbie, of course, record these experiences using a very rich narrative. Now, just hearing those stories that Debbie's told really allows us to see how the whole process of moral evaluation, even retrospectively, is so important for a society that wishes to help to be in solidarity with those with difficult decisions. If we don't acknowledge it, we simply cannot help them. Yes, they did choose abortion, But I would say, how knowingly, willingly and freely did they do this? And I agree with Debbie that quite often I would hardly categorise as a choice, more as an event. And secondly, that where the notion of regret, even in a small way, is not acknowledged, then we can't really have any moral progress on this matter. I just want to end with a little story. In the course of the debate about the abortion legislation a few years ago in Victoria, quite a number of parliamentarians were pressured to vote for the legislation. And one politician said to one of the persons who voted against the legislation for women, for reasons of protecting women, said, "You know, I thought if I voted for the legislation that my partner would feel better about the abortion she had. That if we somehow changed the name of it under the law, she would no longer feel guilt, regret, and sadness. That didn't happen, and I violated my own conscience." What a terrible story. Now, that's a tragedy, I think. That kind of story really is evidence of a sort of nominalist thinking about if we just say it's okay, it will be okay. So just from a few little points about sort of six areas that I think Debbie's talk has so vividly illustrated, far better than I could. But perhaps we, Jovina, can add some other depths and details to that picture. Thanks.
I don't know about depth and detail, Anna, and I think we all agree that our senses and our minds have been quite elevated at this present moment. I'm not really sure how much more I have to offer here, but I'll give it a shot. I'm turning my stopwatch on. Debbie finished off her talk, her presentation, by talking about what we aren't telling women. You know, that is, I will support you. I'm here for you. And the other thing that we're not telling women is what I want to focus on tonight, and that is the actual adverse events related to abortion. It's not a fun topic, and I hope I won't depress us all too much, but I'm going to start by speaking about Rachel, who I met when I was working in emergency a couple of months ago. Young woman in her mid-20s, pretty normal. She was at work one day and she fainted. And so she was brought in by ambulance to emergency, did the usual workup, wasn't a cardiac issue, wasn't a neurological issue. As I talked to her more, I was like, maybe it's something to do with the fact that you had 6 Vs and smoked a packet of cigarettes already today without any breakfast. But that's what I was leaning towards. Anyway, as we talked and I was kind of, you know, it's a busy emergency room, you've got to get through it. She was fine. I was like about to head out the door being like, stop drinking V. She was just like, "I also haven't had my period for 2 months. Do you think that's got anything to do with it?" So I sat down again and took a more thorough history. And it turned out that indeed she maybe had an unwanted pregnancy. So when I just mentioned that to her, the first reaction was a scream and then the question, "How soon can I get an abortion?" So I said, "Hang on a second, we haven't even taken the blood test." So I took the blood test, an hour later I was sitting with her in a room explaining that indeed she was pregnant. Again, she asked the question, "How soon can I get an abortion?" This woman, she went on to tell me over the next half an hour of us talking, so much wanted to be a mum, so badly wanted to be a mum. She planned to have 10 kids. She appreciated her motherhood instantaneously in that moment. By the end of us talking, she was still talking about having an abortion, but she was talking about quitting smoking and cutting down on V. That was how innately she felt her motherhood. She wanted to be a mum, and yet she felt in that moment her only choice in the world was to ask about abortion. And so it's for her that I talk about these things tonight, the real adverse effects of abortion and how it is not the real solution that so many people assume it is. Now, you don't have to be someone that believes in the sanctity of human life to believe my two basic points tonight. One is that abortion is not a real choice, is not the real choice it is touted to be for women. And secondly, that RU486 is not the real safe choice that everyone is about to promote it being for women. So just quickly, surgical abortion, medical abortion. I'm just going to go through the risks actually quite briefly of surgical abortion, because RU486 is what I really want to talk about tonight, because it is the new tsunami. Surgical abortion, I think we all kind of know how it works, dilatation and curettage, a catheter is introduced into the cervix and the fetus is evacuated from the womb. The side effects we know to be cramping, bleeding, nausea, vomiting, fevers, symptomatic of infection, chills, rigors, which are quite scary for young women who've never had them before, and that you may need to go on to have further procedures. You can get cervical lacerations, uterine bowel perforations, scarring, infection, permanent infertility, as well as the fact that you have to go under an anaesthetic, which carries its own risks in itself. So that's a very basic overview of the risks of surgical abortions. Two things in particular that I want to dwell on, and that's things that we have good evidence for, is the effects on future pregnancies. So it's been well documented in over 120 studies that there is a known association between previous abortion and premature birth. And just one study in Aberdeen that took place between 1981 and 2007, so it's quite a highly powered study, lots of women, divided the group of women into two groups. One that were pregnant. One group of pregnant women had had abortions before, and the other group had never had pregnancy before. And they saw that the risk of premature birth in the previous abortion group was 37% higher than the other. It's not insignificant at all. And premature birth is not at all an insignificant adverse event. So 37% higher. And then we can talk about the effects on mental health. Now, there is significant evidence coming all over the world that having an abortion increases a woman's risk for mental health problems, and we've talked about that already tonight. One meta-analysis last year, and a meta-analysis is one of the most sophisticated pieces of evidence that doctors and healthcare professionals have to look at. A meta-analysis kind of groups all lots of different studies together and statistically synthesizes them in a much more effective and analytical manner. Showed an 81% increased risk for mental health problems in women who've had abortion versus those who've not. That is depression, anxiety, substance abuse, suicidality, all not insignificant risks. But enough about surgical abortions. What I really want to talk about right now is RU486, because I have a feeling that my patient, Rachel, were she to go to a Murray Stokes clinic in the near future, would actually be offered a medical abortion. So there's multiple different modes of medical abortion, but the way RU486 works, it's a 200 milligram pill. It works to block progesterone in the uterus, in the endometrium. So when a woman is pregnant, her uterine lining builds up to nurture baby. It's a natural instinct, and that uterine lining is sustained by progesterone, a hormone. RU486 blocks progesterone, causing the uterine lining to shed, and therefore debasing the home that baby's built. RU486 needs to be taken with a prostaglandin as well in order to cause uterine contractions to expel baby and the endometrium. So that's a nutshell how RU486 works. In its practicality, how does it work? Basically, a woman might go to a Murray Stokes clinic. I say Murray Stokes in particular because they have a particular brand, a license to prescribe RU486, as we'll talk about a little bit later. So a woman can go to the clinic, take the first pill, the RU486 pill, and then depending on the protocol, it might be that she's given the prostaglandin pill to take another day later, maybe at home. And then, in theory, she's meant to be followed up and she's meant to come back to the clinic in perhaps 2 weeks to verify that the abortion has been a success. But there's no person who goes to her home and checks she's all right, according to the Murray Stokes protocol. There's no follow-up that's ingrained in that protocol at all. So, theoretically, if a woman wanted to take the two pills, go home and never come back again because she'd never want to talk about it again, that can happen. So it sounds quite simple, doesn't it? Take two pills, go home, don't need to tell anyone, no one needs to know. Sounds like a much easier thing than going to a clinic, having to fast, having to have an anaesthetic, all that sort of thing. But in fact, there's lots of things that can go wrong with RU486, the prime one being infections. So the RU486 by its very nature is an immunosuppressant. So as if having the RU486 pill itself weren't bad enough to cause an infection, you're also immunosuppressing your body so that you're more prone to infections. The other thing that can go wrong with RU486 is, of course, pain and cramping, and nearly all women who take this pill experience severe pain, requiring opioid analgesia, and cramping. So lots of bleeding as well comes with it. Most bleeding goes on for at least 10 days. That's the average bleeding amount. So if it's 10 days, you know, half of women are going to go over it. Half of women are going to be under it, if 10 days is the average. You can also have an incomplete abortion. So we know that in up to 20% of cases, IU486 is unsuccessful and a woman needs to undergo a surgical procedure anyway. And of course, blood loss. So when they first started trialing IU486 in the States, in their very carefully selected group of women, they found that 2% of women hemorrhaged. Some required surgery to stop the bleeding, and some even required blood transfusions. That's in a very carefully fit, selected group of women, 2% hemorrhaged. So why am I talking about in this country? Well, you will recall that in 2006, IU486 was first introduced into this country, and there was a lot of political controversy over that. But at the time, only 187 doctors were allowed to prescribe it. It was heralded as a huge success. Finally, Australia is catching up to the States and to Europe, and finally women, especially in remote areas, can have access to these things. But it's been a real blight that only 187 doctors nationwide have been able to prescribe. Even so, even given the restriction, in the first half of 2011, over 5,000 Australian women were treated with IU486. They were given IU486 to procure a medical abortion. So that's a huge increase over the previous year. So that's over 5,000 women. It's becoming more significant. And we know that in the US and in Europe, up to half of all elective terminations are now carried out with IU486. And of course it would be. Doctors increasingly don't want to perform abortions. This is a safe alternative, promoted to women as a safe alternative. Doctors don't have to get too involved. Seems nice and easy, right? Wrong. In March 19th of this year, the Australian newspaper reported the first known death of a woman in Australia using RE486 to terminate her pregnancy at home. March of this year, so this is the timeline, March of this year. She had gone to a Murray Stokes International Clinic somewhere in Australia in 2010. And why do I say Murray Stokes? Because it's Australia's largest abortion provider and has supervised 18,000 medical abortions in Australia since RE486 became available. We don't know much else about her case because there was no coronial inquiry. A woman dies of a drug that is new, perfectly fit woman otherwise. She dies at home alone and no coroner's inquest. We don't know anything more about her. Nothing else has been able to get through the media. Lord knows how many other women have suffered this way in this country. And doesn't it seem to you like the term bedroom abortion really does apply here? We've been worried about backyard abortions in the past, and now this is what we're doing to women. We've come full circle, and we're telling women to go home, take this pill on your own, no one has to know, alone. The truth is, if you dig really below the surface, it is scary, the lack of good evidence for the safety of RU486. We know in the States, there was a push to get the drug approved through the FDA with much more speed than any other drug has ever been pushed through before because of the political push. This is a dangerous drug. I could go on and on about the studies that have shown the risks to women, and yet in August of this year, having had a report of a death in the community in March, in August of this year it was made much more widely available through Murray Stokes clinics. And we can expect, given that it's been heralded as such huge progress, that in the coming years, perhaps just like in the States, up to half of all elective abortions will be carried out using RU486. And just put yourself in the position of a woman who comes to a clinic, chooses to take the pill instead, thinks this is great, I can just go home, take the pill, no one has to know, I don't even have to go to a surgery. You go home and then the bleeding starts, and then the bleeding keeps going, and then the cramping really hurts. And you think, yeah, they did say something about bleeding. This is probably just normal. But I don't want to tell anyone because they told me to just go home and take it, and I don't want to tell anyone. In fact, the RU486 pill could even increase the moral stigma given to women because she's told that no one has to know. You can just go home and take this on your own. I'm not sure that this really is a real solution for women. There is surprising lack of evidence for RU486 in the community, and it just shows how medical safe practice, medical best practice, is compromised when these issues are at stake. So much so that instead of providing real choices to women, we're providing dangerous choices to women as a standard health regulated policy.
Now, this is all very grim, I know, but I think we should go back to what Debbie finished her talk with. And, you know, I've talked about what we're not telling women, but she focused on what we're really not telling women, and that is, I will be there to support you, and it just takes one person. Thanks.
That was a talk and panel discussion on what are the real choices for women in crisis pregnancy. For more information about Debbie Garrett and Real Choices Australia, visit realchoices.org.au. And for more programs, talks and interviews, go to cradio.org.au.